you can become synesthetic. That implies it's latent in us all, and it's just a matter of a small kind of chemical change. And that kind of idea that you can just become synesthetic through taking some drug or other kind of runs counter to lots of people's ideas that synesthetes' brains are wired so differently, you couldn't possibly just become... So lots of people talk about drug-induced synesthesia.
And hallucination, that I relate
yeah, to. Exactly. Yes. And so some of the first reports were kind of the French press from the 1840s of people taking, peyote, mescal, and other stuff. And having these apparently synesthetic seeing colours. But with hindsight now, if I say that in order to be a synesthete, you have to have a consistent, concurrent, call it a colour, in response to a letter, then I'm sure that those who hallucinate through drug use do see amazing colours. What I'm not convinced of, and I haven't seen any good evidence for, is that those colours are systematically related to a particular inducer. As such, I might want to say, it looks a bit like synesthesia, because it's kind of rich and vivid and colourful, and it's not like what the rest of us get, but it's not synesthesia because it's not systematic, and that has become, for good or bad, part of our definition of synesthesia, that it has to be a consistent mapping of a particular letter or inducer to a concurrent or colour. So a lot of my students do like their kind of library dissertation in their third year is all about what does taking drugs tell us about psychology, and some of them might specialise and say, what does taking drugs, does such a thing as drug-induced synesthesia exist? And many people say that it does, but I haven't seen the good evidence that it... But maybe I want to say there's hallucinations caused by drug use and there's synesthesia. They appear similar, but they're actually fundamentally different.
Yeah, so good.
I think kind of interesting in their own way. How does your perception change through drug use is a very interesting question. I'm very big in the 60s, but then it's kind of outlawed and I can't give my subjects drugs other than this nowadays. But it is kind of interesting question what systematicity is in there. Kind of the way that your perception changes through drug use, why are they systematic, and what those systematicities tell us about how the visual system's wired or your hearing or something.
We'll go here, and then this table, and then that one there.
You took the three shapes yep. and talked about the natural colours. Have you ever run for a large sample to see whether there are sort of clusters that are natural?
So we are just starting to do that. So when we normally bring people to the lab in Oxford, it's whoever can get, and in term time there are more people around, and out of term time it's hard to get subjects, all these younger subjects. Now what we're very excited by is the power of the internet. Things like Mechanical Turk are kind of online pools of hundreds of thousands of subjects. Something that was designed for economics, but we can kind of use it for psychological ends. So currently we're presenting pictures like the plate you saw at the beginning on the internet to tens of thousands of people, and seeing whether they like this plating or that plating, this colour or that colour, and that would be the format or the way in which to do the test. So we are getting there, and we're playing with like handheld technology, mobile phones, and little handheld kind of computing devices that have more computational power than most desktops, and we're just trying to kind of hack the software and systems in order to be able to do exactly those kind of experiments about shapes and colours through everyone's mobile phone as well, so through the internet and mobile technology-based testing. We really want to do that. At the moment, we've been to Namibia, to the Himba of Coco Land, who have no schooling, no written language, to try and see, do they show the same things that Westerners show? We've been to Colombia, and we've been to Taiwan and the Lebanon. But in each case, if we had to go there in person, it's a very slow, difficult process. And we think just through internet-based and handheld technology-based testing, suddenly that's going to completely explode, and you'll be able to test 10,000 people in a week and pay them nothing. To find out just how generalisable these things are, and play with different shades of blue and red and yellow, because those are probably the wrong ones.
I think you should distinguish between people and subjects and volunteers, because on these big data collection things, you're only dealing with volunteers.
Well, it's terminological, in as much as in Mechanical Turk you get paid. Do they make you a subject, I guess? Well,
people don't get paid for responding on the internet.
On Mechanical Turk, they do. You get Amazon credit.
Oh, tell me how to do it.
Not much. Just a few cents. But something, at least. Yeah. You're right, in the mobile phone case, you don't get paid for that. Not quite what makes a subject or a diner. So for Charles Michel, when he comes and prepares a dish for you in our lab, are you a diner, are you a subject, are you a volunteer? It's hard to say so.
Through all this talk this evening, we've been looking at it from an artistic viewpoint. Could you talk to us a little bit about scientists and how scientists are affected and how their work may be or maybe not affected by this condition?
Kekulean.
So, in fact, there aren't many scientists who admit to being synesthetes. Until 1990-something, it was like a weird condition that you wouldn't admit to. Now I think it's respectable and believe it exists, so there's no reason to say I'm not a scientist who believes in God, I'm a scientist who is a synesthete. Richard Feynman, famous mathematician, saw numbers and shapes and colours, and that helped him visualise equations and stuff. There are the odd cases, but there certainly aren't as many synesthetic scientists announcing themselves as you'd expect from population statistics. How it might help, there are claims that synesthesia is some sort of, there are more connections between different parts of the brain in synesthetes than non-synesthetes. That's why we hear colours, and if that's true that there are more connections, that might give you an advantage in creative tasks. It requires you to think differently. So there are a few papers saying, are synesthetes more creative? Do synesthetes, on average, have better memory? It's certainly true in a few particular cases, but as a generalisation, the memory benefits tend to be small. The benefits in terms of creativity are a little bit hard to... They don't hit you in the face, well, you might hope. So what advantages it would give... perhaps not as many as you think. And I think of Shevardnadze S, who was probably the most synesthetic person ever to live from Russia, who was studied by Luria, I think, from the 30s to the 1960s. And he was a Russian, kind of Moscow-based journalist who had synesthesia, but he had every kind of synesthesia all at once. Whenever he tried to read a book, well, that questionnaire, each letter would have a taste, a colour, a shape, to the extent that he couldn't read a page of text, because every single thought or phoneme or grapheme would just send him off in a different direction. That tastes like sour borscht, and that's so it can be detrimental as well. Two forms.
Okay, thank you.
You have one here, and we'll go to this side, then come back.
Okay, any questions? Tell us first. With the cross model modality, can you test it with fMRI? If you have the taste, the colour and the sound, can you see the activity in both areas?
So somebody at your table is quite sceptical about synesthesia.
We have all views on this
too. And at least until 1992 or 3, this was kind of an interesting condition that wasn't really scientifically respectable. It was just weirdos and probably didn't really exist. And what's changed has partly been the fMRI, the brain imaging, to say, okay, let's take a group of 10 or 12 people who claim to be synesthetes, who we can show are reliable in their colours over time, and 12 people who are just pretending to be, trying to imagine colours when they see letters. And it turns out their brains look very different in terms of the areas that are active and in terms of the connections between brain areas. So some of the latest brain scanning techniques I don't understand fully. But more and more studies coming out saying, yes, the brain and the synesthete does look different. And if I map, using diffusion tensor imaging, if I map the kind of connections between the highways between different parts of a synesthete's brain, they are kind of, you know, motorways rather than A roads that there would be in the rest.
Is it bidirectional? If you see the red and A, is it every time you see an A, you see red, and if there's a red,
So this is up for debate at the moment. Yeah. So traditionally, a synesthesia is unidirectional by definition. It is the letter that induces the colour, but the colour does not induce the letter. Unidirectional, from maybe more complex stuff to less complex stuff, from the letter, the grapheme or the phoneme, to just a colour patch. Psychologists have been trying to find the reverse direction, and there are a couple of cases who appear in lots and lots of academic papers, but it's the same two or three synesthetes in all cases, who do seem to show a bidirectionality, that they see emotions or they experience emotions in response to numbers, and numbers do. But that bidirectionality is not consistent and it's not necessarily conscious.
But if you have the psychological theatre said, respond to the colour A, do they say strawberry or do they say it's all the colour red? Do they say A or do they say strawberry?
So they, I mean, maybe all of us might say strawberry in response to red. So they're kind of the things that are common to us all that don't give this conscious concurrent, I don't really see the colour, but all of our brains, when we see red, think sweet. When they see red, we think strawberry. And those kind of mappings are there under the surface in all of us, not conscious. So when I see somebody who apparently has bi-directional synesthesia, but it's not conscious, I wonder, they are synesthetes, but are they also just showing something that we all share? But that is a current debate, an argument about whether it is bi-directional. And then you think, well, maybe if it was bi-directional, you'd be in right old mess, because the letter would cause the colour and the colour would cause the letter, and then you'd be kind of in a... So better that it wasn't. And probably it's from high to low level.
Sorry, something's been mentioned over here then.
Hi. Slightly different direction. I was just thinking with the cuisine
yep.
and the food. Quite often you want to surprise the... and I was thinking like sherbet dips, you know, they're round. Maybe the fact that they're round and not angular makes them more of a surprise when you dip them in and place them.
Yep. So you're right, so that in certain... Normally you'd think, well... What our brains like are things that we expect that are congruent, where each sense pulls together, that it's low pitch and big. And there are some artists, Brazilian artists, I've seen the video, but I can't remember his name or her name, who has a installation which is balls dropping in like a little playpen, but the big balls make high pitch sounds, and the small balls make low pitch, which is kind of incongruent in a way that you weren't expecting, and that's kind of the art there. With chefs, it's very true that lots of the modernist cuisine is all about surprise. It's something that looks like a strawberry but tastes like rhubarb. It's something that's beetroot and orange jelly where the orange is beetroot coloured and the beetroot is orange coloured. It's all about that surprise. And we're very interested in that too. When surprise works and when it doesn't. So we work a lot with Unilever's and Procter & Gamble's and Nestle's. And in the high street, you think that doesn't work. People don't like to be surprised. But when I go for a very expensive dinner, then I'm happy to be. I want to be surprised. I need to be surprised on every course. And there, it seems that we see surprise working mostly in designed expensive experiences. So in a very top-end design store or in a modernist restaurant, where you say, that doesn't match. But I know in a place where it was designed to be such, if I try and do sensory incongruity in the high street, if I try and sell mustard-flavoured ice cream in Tesco, wherever it is, Waitrose, that's probably not going to work because then I'm not in the right context. I'll say, that's just bad food. There's something about the environment, the context in which these things are served that allows you to enjoy incongruity in the modernist restaurant in a way that, and in the top-end design store that you don't elsewhere.
I do notice very few chefs have tried blue food, though, which is a hard one.
Okay. I was wondering if Luria's subject pointed to a thought I had before you mentioned him.
Or participant or volunteer or whatever he was.
No, it wasn't that sort of thought. you're making synesthetic links. No, but an organism, one of the definitions of an organism being alive is that it moves if you stick a pin in it. It's very primitive sensory apparatus might not distinguish between what we now call sense modes, so that vision separated out from auditory and to touch during the process of evolution. So maybe that's an approach to explaining or analysing or something.
So as a woman, Charles and Daphne Maurer, a couple in Toronto, who have a view that we're all born synesthetes.
Yeah.
They're all born with this kind of, what James would call the blooming, buzzing confusion.
Yeah.
The neonate, the newborn, cannot separate out eyes from ears and touch.
Oh, I didn't know he said that. 1890,
whatever it was. They've taken this idea and saying we're all born synesthetes, but through development, the majority of us kind of, we prune connections between the visual brain and the auditory brain, and we're left with the distinction, whereas a few people don't, for whatever reason, their wiring isn't kind of separated out in the same way as the rest of us, and those are the synesthetes, they have residual connections through lack of pruning. That's a prominent hypothesis. I completely disagree with it. And one of the problems might be that for synesthesia, it's very important for the definition that it's, well, how do we know how, for to be synesthetic, it's not just that you feel that A is red, you have to see the redness. So it's very important there's a conscious concurrent, and I don't know what a newborn, how conscious they are. So there's one problem there. There's also a problem that Larry Marks in the States says newborns are experience not synesthesia but monesthesia, which is if they can't discriminate their senses, it's not that one thing causes another, it's just a stew of mixed up sensations. So it is different from us, but it's not synesthesia.
Yeah, motivation or activation.
So, and so what you'd like to see, or what I'd like to see, say, if it's true, and Charles and Daphne Maurer have been saying, we're born synesthetes since 1983 in a book, well, okay, where's the evidence? Let's look at, let's do lots of studies of child development and see it. Three-year-olds are far more synesthetes than four-year-olds and five.
Hmm.
And that evidence hasn't been forthcoming. It's starting to appear. But again, the debate is, I'm saying, what you, these people are showing is the development of these correspondences that we all share, not the synesthesia that's in, that's unique to an individual. But certainly that developmental angle is an important one in theorising.
It's a very strong... I mean, it's not too bad to be 150 years behind James, is it?
Only 120.
A very strong synesthesia, if that's what you call it, which surprised me at the time, 1973, so I'm only 40 years behind that, was the Stroop effect, which was used in demonstrations by the Open University. And that I succumbed to and was very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
You might need to explain it.
Something's a different phenomenon. That's one that's shared by us all. That when we see, when we read, we have to identify the ink colour in which words are written or printed on a screen. Then we're slow if we're trying to say blue, but the word says red, green, or vice versa. So that's indeed a well-known phenomenon. Synesthetes might show Stroop effects that are specific to their colour letter combination that the rest of us don't show.
Mm.
I just read a paper that says all of us could become kind of synesthetes if you read a book where each letter has been painstakingly coloured, A always red, B blue, C green. After reading that book, you will show a Stroop-like effect that's a bit like synesthesia. But what the Stroop effect misses is that just says you're slower to respond when the colour and the letter ink don't match. It doesn't say that you experience a concurrent, a conscious thing. You don't see the colour in which the ink is... or you don't see the colour of the word describing an ink colour, whereas synesthesia is very much, it has to be a conscious concurrent, not just a behavioural tendency.
Well, something causes the conflict.
Sure. Somewhere. But yep, agreed. But it's not conscious, or need not be conscious.
No, I think that.
Alice, do you want to go outside?
I was just going to ask a question about learned associations and whether synesthetes have been examined for, you know, that regularity or their consistency of their...
Yep.
Because I know myself, numbers 1 to 10 have particular colours, but that was actually the system that we learned counting in with Cuisenaire rods when I was at school.
Yep. So people have looked, and since Calkins, 1893, was one of the first to say synesthesia is picking up on the association from coloured school books or fridge magnets, if they existed in 1893, but kind of the coloured letters... when we learnt to read and to write. Since then, people have said, if it was the case that we're just picking up on learning the associations that are present on the fridge or in the language teaching books, then we'd expect more consistency across individuals. That doesn't seem to be the case, therefore it can't be learnt in that way. That said, there is a paper from Winnowar and somebody else in 2010 in Australia that did find some cases of synesthetes whose colour letter mappings could be traced back to the fridge magnets. So in a few cases it does appear to be the case, but in general there's too much idiosyncrasy. There aren't that many books out there. And in a few cases one meets synesthetes who have early memories, if you believe them, of when they were learning to read the colours not matching. And maybe the other case where, so occasional cases of learned associations explaining the colour, grapheme, phoneme connection, maybe more interesting is kind of the tastes, kind of synesthesias, because there you had more of a developmental. We've seen letters throughout our lives, but taste, we only eat baby food at a certain age, and we only eat stuff at another age. And so that learning what tastes and flavours have associations can actually help you to sort of say, well, it was at that point in development when you were using that stuff that you learnt. There was a kind of critical period, and that does seem to be quite early in development, not the baby food, but.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
I just wanted to say, actually, it's quite relevant what I wanted to say to that lady's question over there, which is I come from a family of at least 9 synesthetes, and I'm an identical triplet. Mm-hmm. We are all synesthetes.
Yep.
And interestingly, all our current we have graphene colour synesthetes, and all our colours and numbers and days of the week and months of the year are all quite different.
Yep.
There's no common area of similarity. So even though we were all brought up in the same environment and had the same influences and the same picture books and alphabet books and all the rest of it, it doesn't seem to be that was influential.
Mm-hmm. And then this is another group of family with, I think, 3 triplets and the females in the line. And again, sort of, you see the same things you're saying, that for the triplets, then it's different colours for different days of the week.
Yeah.
It's like view. But some elements of consistency, that Monday's blue of some description for all.
Yeah, actually, that's very weird, because my brother actually tested the whole family a few years ago. And the only area where there was any commonality was Monday being blue.
It's very tall, that's your family.
My ex-girlfriend was one of a family of synesthetes as well. It's the 3 children, the mother, the grandmother, but not the father, so it seems to be more common in a female side of the family.
Actually, that was what we wanted to ask you. My sister-in-law here has a daughter who's synesthetic, and we just wanted to ask you about the genetic side of it, because it does look like it's very much a family trait.
Yep.
And we have actually done genetic tests. Several family members have sent their saliva off, but we never really got the results, which is rather aggravating, so we don't know, but apparently that's what they are.
So ever since
testing in the States.
So this is the first reports from the 1840s from sort of French journalists about synesthesia or these hallucinations induced by drugs. The first scientific paper is 1880 from Francis Galton, who's thinking about mental imagery when we see things that aren't there, and at the same time thinking about coloured numbers in nature. And then back then in 1880, he notes it's more common in females, tends to run in families. And that seems to have held up those both claims to today. That said, like all of these things in synesthesia, there's some debate. Definitely does run in families, no doubt about that. There are certain parts of the world, so in some parts of Ireland, there's something in the genetics. I mean, there are far more synesthetes there than elsewhere. In terms of the more common in females, that seemed like it was like a hard and a solid fact. But it turns out that many of the studies that claim that females are more likely to be synesthetic than males were based on returns from the back of magazines. So when Simon Baron Cohen did the study, the most famous study in Cambridge, then it was, you know, if you have this condition in the back of the CAM magazine, then phone this number, and it turns out women are more likely to respond to newspaper adverts than men are. And now I've seen a few papers that say, in fact, is there really a sex difference at all? Some people are not so sure. But definitely that it runs in families is true. And there's a group, Asher and others, somewhere in Oxford University, who are looking at the genetics and trying to find exactly the genetic markers. And so far they haven't been able to identify a particular genetic mutation. It seems to be a number of things that can give rise to synesthesia. So that is an active area for some research groups.
Before we move on, I was going to ask whether in your coming across synesthetes you've noticed that they're drawn towards particular careers. And I wonder if I could, before you answer, can I ask the lady at the back, is there any kind of commonality in the kind of careers that your synesthetic family has gone into? Have they been drawn towards more creative careers or not?
No, I don't think so. There's quite a lot of writing and journalism goes on, and there's been some teaching. and a lot of interest in music. We are quite an artistic family, I suppose, rather than scientific. In fact, there aren't any scientists.
I'm just, in a way, kind of connected back to the previous question, that maybe if synesthetes are drawn towards things that are not very scientific, that might explain why there aren't so many in science, because perhaps they feel they need to use that different way of seeing the world, particularly.
Yeah. So some of the philosophers would say synesthesia, it doesn't give you anything extra that's not, you don't actually perceive directly. Just have the synesthesia just is another way, it's like a colour that you link to something you already hear or taste, but something extra given by that synesthetic experience. Others might say, well, no, I was speaking to an infrasound composer 2 weeks ago who makes sounds that no one can hear. You can feel them in your gut as they vibrate at 200 hertz or something. So, infrasound composer doing her PhD in Paris, and she's also a synesthete. And she's saying for her, then she can tell differences between timbre of different instruments through the colours that they are associated with, which we kind of argue against what the philosophers say. There's nothing extra information given, but she used it, and it could help her to make discriminations that the rest of us, she thought, could not make. We'll be looking at chefs to see whether they are more synesthetic. There are some who talk. So there's one, Paul Bertoli in California, who used to run the Olivetti restaurant. He designs his menus, according to his book, around shape. He starts with dishes that are very pointy, and then through the course of the 6-course meal, the shapes that are elicited by the tastes get more rounded. He says any meal should start pointy and go kind of very round at the end. Is he really a synesthete, or is he just kind of talking in that way? It's hard to say. And who was Chef Cantu in Completely Mad, North American Chef? He also claims to be synesthetic, but again, is he really, or is he just playing it really? Are you drawn to a certain... Anyway, I've seen a few studies looking at the creativity and the memory, and the, a few of my students do projects on our artists more likely to be synesthetes than non, but not an easy answer.
I was just wondering, we've been talking about just association with colours and letters and things. What about notes? Do the synesthetes that you know, I mean, I don't know any, do they think about some things in sounds?
Mm-hmm. So the most common type, probably 70% of examples of synesthesia are coloured letters, either seen or heard. The coloured grapheme, coloured phonemes, that's the most common type. Are there synesthetes who experience tastes in response to music, either to pitches or to musical, a major second if that exists, something like that? There are. Of course, that may be some of those. Music taste synesthesias require a certain degree of musical knowledge. If to be able to identify them.
Like
yes, consistent, yes. So there have been a few papers in Nature from Bealey and colleagues in 2005, and there was a particular synesthete who, for particular musical bits and pieces, had very particular tastes. For S, the Shevardnadze, the man with the amazing memory, tested by Luria in Russia, he too had tastes and flavours and food textures associated with particular pitches of sound, and Leroux would be there playing different pitches of sound with a tone generator, and S would say that's this taste, that's that taste, that is something else. Yeah. So they do exist, they're much rarer. And in fact, so there are some websites, like the Sean Day in the States has a website that anybody can go to, the American Synesthesia Association, say I'm synesthetic, I have this. This inducer, this sound, this taste, this texture, this colour, this shape, this emotion, this pain, this gives rise to that bizarre, unusual, concurrent colour, shape, taste, sound. And he just tots up the figures of all the people who go to his website. And he's got 600 or 1,000 different synesthetic examples. And they find almost any combination of senses is possible in synesthesia. There are two that are missing. One that's of interest to us is that there's nobody with a smell-taste synesthesia. And I think that's because we all naturally confuse smells and taste. We all say vanilla, caramel, strawberry, sweet. Well, the sweet's just taste, but vanilla caramel, strawberry, our smells. And so I think we all think we've lost our sense of taste when our nose is blocked with a flu or something. So I think we're all actually synesthetic for that pairing. And there's one other pairing that hasn't been documented so far. And you kind of think if what synesthetes differ in is in terms of how... So people would say, Ramachandran would say, the reason why coloured numbers and coloured letters is so common, 70% of cases, is because in the brain these two things are colour and graphemes are represented right next to each other. So it's not much of a... just takes a few extra wires and you've got that kind of cross-connection. Whereas if I think about tastes and music, well, taste is somewhere at the front, sound is somewhere at the back. That's a lot further for a stray connection to go, and hence that's why that is a less likely combination to be seen, I might say.
My question was around, you've spoken about the specific experience of synesthetes and then also the more broad cross-modal commonalities that correspondences that the population see. I wondered if you could expand a bit on any similarities and differences in the origins of those.
I could do that at length. That's the main thrust with the philosopher Ophelia de Roy in London, and they were spending all our time thinking about what's the similarities and differences. And it's really difficult, in a way, because if you go back to the 1840s, the journalist in 1880, Sir Francis Galton, first in print in an academic journal talking about synesthesia, through Calkin in 1893 talking about these learned associations between colour and shape, through behaviourism and back and brain imaging, through 150 years of psychology and neuroscience, synesthesia and its correspondences have become popular and less popular, just in perfect tandem. And you see all the artists, the scientists, saying these are the same thing. And Daphne Meyer and Charles Meyer, who say we're all born synesthetes, Ophelia get very upset, because we think they're confusing the real synesthesia, these idiosyncratic matches, with the stuff that we all share. We all think low pitch is dark, big, low in space. So what we're trying to do at the moment is pull these things apart and say, no, they're very different. The reasons why they're different is, well, what is synesthesia? How do you define it? And that's a tricky thing, because the synesthesia research is kind of slippery and they have different definitions that change, and you can't pin them down and say, what exactly do you mean? What they mean is that there's a conscious concurrent, an inducer or a letter, you can actually see the colours, a conscious concurrent. It's idiosyncratic. Each two synesthetes don't experience the same thing. And it's automatic. Whenever I see the letter, I see the colour. There's no ifs or buts. So CIA, conscious, idiosyncratic, automatic, and maybe a few other criteria. Is that true of these correspondences? I think no. If I play you a blurt sound, you don't see blackness, you don't see a big shape. It'll affect your performance like the monkeys and the humans in this kind of reaction type test, but there's no conscious concurrent. It's not idiosyncratic, so I think it's shared by everyone in the population. And so the pitch size thing is the law of physics or something, so that should be shared by everybody all over the world, human, non-human. And automatic, maybe that's shared in two cases. And you can go through, so maybe we've got like 15 different criteria that fall in some people's definition of synesthesia, but not others. And you say that's different from synesthesia, from these correspondences, so they're very different things, we think. That's a battle that's ongoing. We're still getting rejected from the journals when synesthesia researchers say, no, we didn't mean that. And I think these correspondences can be learned. If I gave you a new object, maybe one of these, and I make it a new sound, you can learn an association between a new taste, a new flavour, a new shape, and new sound. You can learn these things in a way that synesthesia is hardwired, it's fixed from some early point in development, and you can't learn new colour music combinations later in life. You just got what you've got, and that's it. So they don't change through experience, where correspondences do that. It's like a constant statistical updating, picking up on what's common in our environment and allowing us to predict things. So different in that way. But the battle's still ongoing, and hopefully in a year or two we'll convince some people to keep these things separate, at least until we can show that they're the same. And maybe if you're a brain imager, you say, okay, which parts of the brain are different in synesthesia and not? And there's a bit in the parietal cortex at the back here that if you are a synesthete, you see colours when you think of or see letters. If I put a magnet on here and I temporarily give you brain damage, just with a TMS coil, I can temporarily suck out the electrons. I can make you not synesthetic. I can also make you not show the Buber Kiki effect. Somewhere roughly the same area, but it's actually slightly different. So I think it's a really interesting debate, very hard to resolve because of these things have been so intertwined for 150 years. But we think we've got criteria where we can say these things are different. But when we try and fight with the synesthesia researchers and say we didn't really mean that, it's not. And everyone's got a different definition of the condition.
You talked about Kandinsky being synesthetic, and I love Kandinsky, although I'm not a synesthetic. What about other artists like Van Gogh? Is there any evidence for other artists having this condition?
Plenty of other artists. I think Van Gogh doesn't appear in a... No, he's not in, it's not in the index, so he wasn't one. But there are many others. What have we got here? Baudelaire, Rimbaud, Scribner. So they all tend to be around 1900-ish. Kandinsky, Messiaen, Bokov, Sergei Eisenstein, David Hockney, Basho Matsuo, Richard Feynman. Not in here. I think it seems to be... Of a particular epoch that people were especially... And then David Hockney now, but he turns out to be a real one.
Jeff in the middle.
Did you say there was a name
for it? So I'm kind of curious about Kandinsky as well. I just don't get what you're trying to find out from looking at him. Because it seemed that the first half of your talk is talking about artists and these particular cases. And then you got to a point and you had this gesture that said, actually, I don't really care about them. What I'm interested in is the bigger stuff which can make money. For marketing purposes and all that. Kandinsky's good buddies with Schoenberg, who uses colour all the time to describe his music. Mm-hmm. And the idea of aspiring to the condition of music is massively bound up with the history of 19th century German aesthetics and this, interest in abstraction. Mm-hmm. So I just seriously don't get what you're doing with Kandinsky, and I'd be curious to know sort of experimentally how that works. Particularly, you said you were interested in the difference between plating food inspired by a Kandinsky painting, as opposed to food that looked a bit the same but wasn't inspired by it. Mm-hmm. And I do not understand at all how you look into that.
Okay, so you've got 15 ingredients that you can array as you wish in a plate for a diner or restaurant. If I just toss them together, there's not really much effort involved in that. I can then, through effort, arrange them in what seems like a effortful or possibly artistic way, and that was the Grand Chats kind of dessert, and that was Kandinsky. Both look effortfully designed, and what we worry is that people say, yes, the food that has been effortfully designed, such as somebody who's trying to copy Kandinsky, that's worth more, but it's worth more just because of the amount of effort I imagine it must have taken to prepare it, in which case the Kandinsky and the Grand Chats must be worth as much. And so what we're trying to say is, well, no, is there something more than that that you get when there's kind of an artistic element? It's not just the amount of efforts involved, but that it appeals to some higher...
But that just sounds massively tenuous.
Sure. That's an empirical question.
Right. And how's that going?
Good. So far we've shown that the Kandinsky plating... people will say it's worth more, it tastes better, they'll actually eat more of the food than when we have exactly the same thing but laid out in 15 ingredients or as a pile on the plate.
But that's not the comparison, though.
No, that's the one that's coming next.
Yeah, right.
And how that will turn out. I mean, if it turns out, well, just the amount of effort you put into presentation of the place is all that matters, well, so be it. That's kind of interesting in its own regard. And no one has published on that. What we're hoping to show is there's something beyond just the amount of effort that's involved, whether we will or not. I can't say for sure. Okay. But what we're going to say is just, I mean, for us it's interesting that all these artists are all audiovisual.
Right.
They never think about, there are no synesthetic chefs for 100 years ago. That's kind of curious, why is it that, if they are synesthetic, why
isn't
is it?
Isn't that a question of recording? Isn't that just about the, because we now, it's now easy to talk about chefs as artists. It wasn't so easy to do that 100 years ago.
Apart from you had people like, is it? And
of course, you've got
Karen.
Sofia and you've got people who talk about it in terms of theatre, but you have shifting discourses that make it more or less easy to talk about Heston Blumenthal as a creator.
Yep. But you have people talking about culinary architecture, Karen, for example.
Right.
So you're right, the movie's less of it, and that's part of our interest as well, working with art historians and philosophers, saying, can we think of food as art now? and it's kind of tenuously linked to this dish, because that brings up some questions. Is it art? Certainly not, probably. But you could describe it as such. But then you say, why is it not art? Why could it be art? How can we think about food as art now? And why are many of the chefs, like the Adriers and the Blumenthals, talking as, you know, that we are the artists? Is that a fair thing to say? Well, not if you think, but the art has to be something about beyond just fulfilling bodily needs. And so that is kind of a separate question there. So kind of for us, it's just, we work with a chef anyway, Charles Michel. He went to see the picture and was inspired by it and created a dish. That's it.
It's not just because there's more money in selling this stuff to...
Oh, there's no money in that particularly.
But you're doing research and development.
Separately.
For people who then...
Separately. Yeah. Separately from that.
As
so
long as they pay you enough so that
no, no.
The university...
But Charles Michel is just fun.
Right.
He doesn't have a restaurant. He just is a chef who's kind of freelancing. And it's just he was inspired by the dish. And as a psychologist, it's true, most of our funding comes from food companies. Somebody's got to pay for it, and the government doesn't. So somebody's got to pay for it, they pay for that. But at the same time, the money that the companies pay allows us to do other stuff. And with Charles Michel, who's a freelance chef,
right.
We're interested. And with the money we get from industry that funds the lab, he can come to Oxford and we can do this dish. No one's paying for that.
Right.
It's just our curiosity.
But meanwhile, you sell more people more fizzy water, which is really bad for the environment, having to carry around.
So that's just an observation. We're not working with any
right.
drinks manufacturers. We're just saying that's what's in the marketplace. You didn't realise it. We're pointing it out to you. We're telling you what's true of the world, how
right.
you're being manipulated.
Right.
We're not selling
all open source so that we can then
yes.
make better decisions
yeah.
about what we're
yeah.
doing.
And so I give him my defence.
Yeah.
The fact that we're not working with Perrier or Heineken or any of the others, but we might be, not on this. but we have got a grant in the European Union at the moment, together with the Paul Bocuse Cookery School and Friesland Campana in the Netherlands, which is all about using these ideas to promote healthy eating.
Cool. And he's got a big organ in his dining room, so we should do some stuff with that.
Who has?
Paul Bocuse.
Well, he looks like he's pickled to me, but we've been to his restaurant. So. I think on the one hand, are we evil in the hands of companies? In a way, sort of yes, but no one else is paying for this. And I think for us, we're doing work with industry, yes.
No,
but there's a hint of, yeah, you're in the hands of. But that allows us to play and to have fun. And we are very committed, as much as we can, to saying, working with the chef. If we find out that the more artistic plating makes people eat more, think the food's more healthy, that's something that might play out. We'll play with it. And what is a healthy food? That's another philosophical question.
Yeah.
But as much as we can identify healthy foods, can we use some of these ideas about shapes? What is the shape of healthy? What is the speech sounds that connote healthy? Can we use those ideas? Not for Coca-Cola, for the San Pellegrino. We've put the grant in. We rejected once. We're reapplying now. If they fund us, we'll do it. But it requires the money for those things.
Can I just slightly cut this short? There are people having to go for their buses, I'm well aware. But there's also an artist in the room. We'll just come back on that point. Can we make this the last thing? And then anyone who wants to stay and chat to Charles, that's fine.
Looking at the Kandinsky plate, I was just thinking the scaling's a bit wrong in that, okay, it looks a bit like sick. But I think if you scaled it up a bit and the actual, you could see like sections of kiwi fruit or bits and pieces like that, it might be a clearer experiment.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is, so Charles Michel in Bogota at the moment is doing a huge canvas version. So there's questions of scale.
It
needs to
be eatable, though.
Yeah, yeah, scale, but it could be the one plate as big as this wall, as this screen, for everybody to come and share.
Yeah.
So you're right, the questions of scaling, do you lose something when it's just a small canvas that's not the true size, probably? But we'll take a look at that. And also thinking about different ways of interacting with the dish, either to use a paintbrush, a spoon, or to use your fingers, and just kind of do it that way. And if you do it shared eating versus individual eating... And does it matter the orientation? So I guess the painting should be that way up. If we serve the plate that way or the other way, would you lose something or not? Still as much effort involved in the preparation, but is there something you need to have? So suddenly it gets you into lots of questions about visual arts and reproductions and size and scaling and orientation that we haven't addressed yet, but we're kind of interested in. And just it just throws up when we think about plating, because there's no psychology of the plating of dishes, really.
I picked up on the aesthetic aspect,
yep.
but it just didn't look appealing to me.
So that is kind of the makes things that aren't looking in the right colour here. That's part of the problem about doing online studies. How do you know what people's monitors are set to? You can never ensure that exactly the same colours will be present. You just hope that across a large enough sample size, any differences in monitor will kind of be averaged out. But at the same time, at the moment, we're still kind of tentative in that we'll do online studies with people's monitors at home, so who knows what they look like, and in the lab when you actually see the food and we say, here it is, in its true colours, with the Oxford covered market ingredients. How much do you like it there? And hopefully we'll find some correlation between different ways of plating, artistic or not, effortful or not, online versus in real life. And that will say, okay, if in this case we've been able to show that the online tasting gives us the same results as in the lab testing, and you can really see the food, then we'll be confident to do more things just in the virtual or on the online.
Right, I'm sorry guys that we winded it up there just so we don't kind of take all night for people who need to go away elsewhere. Before I say my thanks, so just a little bit of kind of flagging up. So we talked about the Oxford Science Festival. Martha, would you say a little bit more about the Affecting Perception?
Affecting Perception is a project that we're running in Oxford over March, and it consists of an art exhibition at the O3 Gallery, which is in the Oxford Castle, which looks at artists who have neurological conditions and those who are surviving neurological change. And then we've got 9 seminars, of which this is the 4th one. And then there's all sorts of outreach events as well. But there's some flyers on your tables, and yeah, they're all free, and it'd be great if you wanted to come down and give us your feedback about
it. And one of your artists is since...
Oh yeah, one of our artists, John Adams, who's actually giving a seminar later in the series with Simon Baron Cohen, who was mentioned earlier. He does have synesthesia, and he talks about time having shape and colour and yeah, days of the week, and similar to...
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for
the information. No problem. And coming up on in Cafe Side, just let me get the dates right. So 9th of April, for those who aren't used to it, we meet on the second Tuesday of every month, apart from August. 9th of April is the peculiar substance graphene, which those interested in science may have seen talking about in the newspapers. One molecule thick layers of carbon have very peculiar properties. The 14th of May, we've got the science of trying to capture wildlife on film, which is perhaps a little less on the scientific side than we sometimes do, but definitely interesting. And the 11th of June, Don Mottram's coming to talk about is the acrylamide in cooked foods such as crisps and chips bad for us. It's a well-known hazardous chemical, and it's made when we fry things. So we'll see about that. But all those dates and details of speakers are on our website. That's www.cafeside.org. You can put /Oxford on it if you want to, but it will default to that anyway. That also is where I'll be putting up the audio in, I hope, the next couple of days from tonight. And that also has audio from quite a few of our previous cafes of the last year and a half or so. So that is all fine. On the website, you can also sign up for the mailing list, and that will then give you our regular alerts and reminders that cafe is coming up and how the programme's developing through the year as we start to go into the new season in the autumn. Thank you very, very much to my helpers, to Science Oxford Live, of course, to Affecting Perception. Biggest thanks for all to our speaker tonight, Professor Charles Spence. So we're going to take Charles out to dinner, but we have to queue up first, so please come and entertain him while we're here.